This is the Brickcourt Chambers Centenary Podcast.
Hello, I'm Finn Pilbrow, and I'm very pleased to welcome you to this Centenary Podcast series. It's 100 years since what is now Brickcourt Chambers was founded by William Jowett. To mark our 100th birthday, we are bringing together past and present members of Chambers to discuss their experiences in practice, on the bench, and in all sorts of places that a career in law has taken them. Through these conversations, we hope to celebrate past achievements, discuss current issues, and hear opinions on what lies in store in the future. In this programme, it is the turn of Brickcourt's mediators. Over the last 20 years, mediation has developed into a core part of Chambers' professional offering, a development mirroring the increasingly prominent role of mediation in commercial litigation. There are now 15 mediators listed on Chambers' website. We brought together four of the busiest and best known of them to chat about the past, present and future of mediation, covering topics such as working as a mediator within a barrister's chambers, the relationship of the bar as a whole with mediation, and the role that mediation could and should play in resolving disputes of all shapes and sizes. They are Stephen Ruttle QC, Tony Willis, Supervisor QC and, chairing the discussion, Bill Wood QC.
Welcome to this podcast. This is Bill Wood welcoming you all to a meeting of a cell of mediators, if that's the right collective noun, who live and work in the bosom of a set of barristers' chambers, peacemakers among a group of warriors, or the art department. I don't know how we quite think of ourselves. Turn first to Stephen Ruttle. The rest of us, Sue, Tony, me, We're lateral hires, Stephen, to use the fashionable phrase, but you're homegrown Brickcourt product. You highly successful reinsurance and insurance silk, and something happened. You are now, of course, a highly successful international and London-based commercial mediator. But I suppose question one is, how did it all go so wrong for you?
Thanks, Bill. One of the things that struck me as I was thinking about the podcast, and it's a point which is, in one sense, easy to be overlooked, is that Brickcourt has devoted a full podcast to mediation. And I think that no other comparable set of chambers, probably no other comparable set of solicitors for that matter, would have done so. And I think it's interesting, as I look back over 45 years of being in Brickcourt, just to see the way in which Brickcourt has adapted to new processes and how it's integrated so, I think, seamlessly into the dispute resolution services that it offers. As Bill said, I kicked off here in 1976. The mid-90s, I developed a reinsurance and insurance practice. And at this stage, I think mediation was still very much in its infancy. The problem was no one really knew what it was. There was the sort of the soft end viewpoint, which were the sort of what might be called the meditation mystics, who saw it as a process whereby people sat in a corner and quivered when an alchemy was delivered by the mediator, hardened litigators, going over all sort of soft and cooey. At the other end was the sort of the hard-nosed approach, the sort of the medication mafia, someone described it, where you head-banged people in a corner to force them into some form of solution or compromise.
So, Stephen, you did your course with CEDA, the Centre for Effective Dispute Resolution, in 97, 96. When you settled my reinsurance practice in large part and left my family penniless and hungry, you were a freshly minted mediator. I thought you were a seasoned performer by then.
No, that was 2 years in, and Bill knocked at the door, and there was this face that appeared. He said, I'm going to say, well, actually, online what he said, but he was extremely irritated. Now, I'd been doing it for a couple of years then. I was trying to integrate mediation into a traditional barrister's practice, giving legal advice, as appearing in court, what the chambers called real work. And I was adding into that the unreal work of mediation. For me, the crunch came about 3 or 4 years later in 2002, when I decided, I think I was probably the first QC to do so entirely, to give up real work, barrister's work, and devote myself entirely to commercial mediation. I wanted, though, to remain in chambers as a full tenant. And there was a real issue about whether or not chambers wanted me in that role. Christopher Clark at that stage was was head of chambers. Dear boy, he said, dear boy, I think it would be a wonderful idea. Will all of us benefit? And perhaps the fact of this podcast may indicate that he got it absolutely right.
Yeah. Tony, you and I think you and I co-mediated in the early noughties. I think the invitation for you to join us was issued after that. But you'd been mediating really for longer than Stephen had been mediating, hadn't you?
I'd had the benefit of being in heavy litigation for a very long time for a lot of clients, including a lot of American banks. The American banks, particularly those based in California, and you'll guess who that is, were early into this field. And so I had, even in the 1980s, some experience of the attitudes that American lawyers and American clients had to this process. And I spent some time talking to them about that. I then got trained by CEDA in their first training session way back in 1990. In Clifford Chance, as it then was, having had a lot of experience of bullying lawyers as a managing partner, I could increasingly see the benefits of lawyers doing something which was slightly softer than I'd been doing for the rest of my career. And the result was that I got trained. I did some of it while I was still in Clifford Chance. I retired from Clifford Chance as the third oldest partner in the place. Thought it was about time. And amazingly, having set up a shingle from my study at home, found myself flat out being an independent mediator.
Brick Court offering, as it now sits, of which you're an absolutely vital part, how do you see that in the framework of the mediation ADR world as a whole?
It's an ideal setting, it seems to me, first of all, because it's economically very viable. The costs are extremely low. You're in the midst of a bunch of extremely good and nice and intelligent people who do the same sort of things that one does. So it tends to socialize people like me who would otherwise be regarded as a bit of a misanthrope. And it is perfect, it seems to me. And the cell, as you described it, works extraordinarily well.
Sue, you've joined us with brilliant timing at the very start of lockdown and the pandemic. So I'm not going to ask you what it feels like to be working and living in the setting of Barrister's Chambers, because I don't really think you've yet had the full glory of the experience. But as it stands at the moment, you haven't quite shaken off the demands of the dark side. You're still doing quite a lot of advocacy. Your clients won't let you go. But you're clearly cutting a tremendous swathe on the mediation field. You're fitting this podcast into the three you're doing this week, I understand. How does, for starting with the question really of the bar as the place to be and the bar as it appears in your mediations, how is it all looking to you at the moment?
I mean, let me say, first of all, I joined Brick Court because of you, Bill. You taught me on my CEDA course, and surprisingly let me come through. And I have done many, many mediations with you, successfully and unsuccessfully, and always been massively impressed. But yes, I came here at the beginning of lockdown, and it's been a very bizarre experience. And although I've seen mediations, obviously, from as leading counsel, as instructing solicitor to leading counsel, and now as a mediator, I think there's no general rule as to whether barristers are helpful in mediation. I suspect I was never very helpful in mediations. I think it depends very much on the case and on the barristers in question. I think there were a lot of people I know who pride themselves on never having settled anything in a mediation. But my experience, I think, in the last year or so has been that barristers can be very useful. I mean, and very helpful in analysing cases. I think they have their client's trust and confidence. And if the client is going to have to live with a settlement ultimately, she or he, needs to have the help of their trusted advisors when they're reaching that settlement. And they can also be very helpful in keeping the lid on the conversation and managing difficult clients. So I'm all for barristers being involved and solicitors being involved in mediations.
Slight question at a tangent, but are you finding yourself drawn into discussions of the merits more than you expected?
I mean, I try not to be too evaluative. I am by nature quite a forceful personality. And a lot of people say to me about mediation that, you know, mediators need to be more robust and give an opinion. I think it's quite tricky, however, because I think you have to be very careful that you don't upset the lawyers around the table, that you don't embarrass anybody, and that you do this in a very sort of, you know, careful, thoughtful way.
Tony, the bar in your mediations, asset, obstacle? How do you see them?
Endlessly variable. I mean, if you consider the range of people who come along to mediations, from chief executive, chairman, finance director, dog's body, maybe some of the experts and so on, lawyers of all stripes and competencies, it seems to me that I want the parties to be represented and to be able to turn to their advisors at every stage. I don't want a discussion to carry on along the lines of, oh, that's very difficult, I'm going to have to go and talk to counsel next week, and I know he's in a big trial, so I can't do that, so we'll have to end this here. I need them there in the room. I'm also very keen that they should be there because it enables me, from my junior knowledge of the world of the law, to take one of them aside on their own, that's away from their client, and say, I simply don't understand why you're making this point. Tell me, educate me. Why is it that you're right about this issue? Surprisingly often, they tend to say, oh, well, all right then, it's probably not a very good point. I haven't embarrassed them with their client. I haven't upset the apple cart, so as I completely agree with Sue, you have to do it carefully. Barristers are good or bad, solicitors are good or bad, and I could tell you awful stories about the other side of the profession behaving badly. Equally, there are many clients who behave extremely badly, badly in the sense of not getting the sense of what they want to really get to, which is a deal.
Stephen Barr, catching up, getting the hang of it. How are you finding them?
Yep, definitely. I very much agree with what Sue said earlier. I used the expression earlier about mediation being about disagreeing well. One of the things that has struck me, switching from barristering to mediating, is how often parties genuinely and often with good reason disagree, and they will continue to disagree. I used to say that when I met my clients in mediation that the purpose was to settle the dispute. I don't usually say that now. I now normally say the purpose of the mediation is to make a wise decision. And the wise decision normally involves settlement because most people don't want to spend the next couple of years fighting battles with each other. So if you're looking at it in that context, disagreeing well, making a wise decision, as a mediator, you need all the help you can get because you've got parties who aren't going to agree and who don't want to move into the area where they can find a deal. Therefore, as a mediator, I need as much assistance as I can get from the party's advisors. And I found the bar to be increasingly efficient. There is an objectivity, an independence, an ability just to stand back and say, now look, you probably need to move that bit further, that I find invaluable. So I'm a big supporter.
Sue, you talked a moment ago about being counsel in mediations, being counsel in some of my mediations, in which I may say I give you a good mark. You weren't obstructive. You were very helpful. But how does that feel? Make it more specific. How does it feel when you're making a point in a mediation and you think the mediator probably doesn't really buy it and that even that the mediator might be right? Tell us about that.
Well, it's sort of difficult. I mean, mediations work very well for me generally. I mean, but I did often find myself taking you aside and trying to explain, you know, why my arguments might not have been quite as strong as I'd put them in front of the clients. You know, I think there's quite a lot of back chat that goes on in mediations between counsel and mediators, counsel and the other side. And I think that's all very helpful because I think that moves the debate
along. You want help reducing your clients' expectations sometimes.
Absolutely.
Quite often. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know that I settled a lot on the day as counsel, and that might have been because my clients' expectations were unrealistic needs. But I mean, I think you start sowing the seeds and the parties start thinking about settlement, and it's more likely than not that they end up settling. And I think that's the way it works. It's sort of an iterative process.
And Tony, you got the longest horizon on this. Was there an Elysian period when everybody was overawed by the idea they were mediating and felt they had to settle, or was it always a few getting through the net?
Well, they may have thought it was Elysian. I never thought it was. The great enthusiasts needed to be put back in their box regularly, even in the very early days. If you took a really realistic view of what we were doing. What the lawyers of all stripes, both solicitors, barristers and others, have to understand is who they're talking to and who they're trying to persuade of things and what they're trying to persuade them of. if as the lawyer in the mediation you come across as an awful shit, or you insult the chief executive of the other side, as you may well do in court in front of a judge because you're seeking to make a point, you've probably set the entire negotiation process, and that's after all what we sell a negotiation process and a guidance into that, back by eons of time, because they won't get out of their head the fact that they were insulted and start thinking about the things they need to. And this step that lawyers of all kinds, both solicitors and barristers, need to get across is working out what they're seeking to do and who they're seeking to persuade. And it's a critical step.
Do you think it makes a difference now that the court is mandating ADR and sanctioning parties that aren't taking part in mediations?
It undoubtedly does. On the other hand, it increases the resistance to some extent, because people will turn up and say, I don't want to be here. I'm only here because the bloody judge told me I had to. And what the hell are you doing anyway?
Do you hear that often?
Yeah,
I used to hear it, and occasionally I perceive the attitude at the back of their heads going on, but they don't say it.
I mean, you occasionally get it, but you ought to be able to explain to the parties that there is a benefit in the process. And even if they've arrived quizzical, provided that one can, I think, encourage them to see the benefits of the process, they normally get that.
I mean, the opening line, I'm only here because the contracts made me come, is often said by people who've got every intention of settling, but they want to get the best possible moral position at the beginning of the day. I'm a fantastic case. 200 years of litigation experience, never seen a fraud case stronger than this.
Take a 5% discount on a bad day.
I've got to be here. I mean, that man is, woman is screaming to settle, you can tell.
I think barristers are only human also. I always think, you know, I don't know many barristers who like fighting bad cases in court. So if you have an opportunity through a mediation to settle it and settle it well, then you'll take it.
Overall, we're talking about a huge improvement in the quality of life for the participants, because what mediation does is just bring forward the focus from the eve of trial. So instead of that terrible moment outside court when your QC suddenly tells you, well, you know, actually, I've read their skeleton argument now. They've actually got a point. And you hear people screaming, you know, what's changed since our conference 2 years ago when I had reasonable prospects of success? Well, the answer is we're now all focusing on it. And it's that sharp focus. And if that can be brought forward to a mediation.
But I had a mediation this last week where one side refused to highlight any of the strengths in their case or the weaknesses in the other side's case. So they were saying that there was lots of documentary evidence, which would be wonderful in cross-examination, but they weren't going to give any examples of it to the other side because they wanted to save it for cross-examination.
Yeah,
so we had this ridiculous standoff where the one side was saying, well, tell me why my case is terrible. And the other side was saying, well, I'm not going to tell you because actually I want to cross-examine you on it. So we didn't advance the debate particularly.
I know. I mean, story about David Shapiro, that he, who was one of the leaders, you all know him very well, no longer with us, sadly, but he absolutely prepared a case, almost to the point where he could have argued it in court one way or the other the following day. And if somebody said to him, David, you've got to trust me, we've got a drawer full of documents that demonstrate this point, and you know, they'll be available at trial. So, you know, you've only done a brief bit of preparation. Shapiro would say, bring them here. Get in a cab. Bring me those documents. I want to see them. I mean, he would really push people. I wouldn't dare do that. Stephen, I get a bit nervous when I hear people saying this commercial mediation stuff works really well. We should be applying it in politics, in the community, in all sorts of different disputes, even when there's no litigation in the background. And I know you have been closely involved in a number of areas in which there isn't litigation in the background. Is that rewarding,
yes.
Successful? Is it effective?
2 or 3 years ago, it's pre-COVID, I had an assistant in a mediation, commercial mediation I was doing, and she asked me what did I think, looking back over 17 or 18 years, was the single most effective aspect of the whole process. And I said that, to be absolutely honest, it probably wasn't anything I did, but it was the opportunity that the process provided for people to have conversations with each other. And one of the aspects of litigation is people stop talking to each other. And that cessation of engagement or contact has consequences because you start to believe the worst rather than the best about the other person. So opening up dispute to individuals, humanising the dispute, focusing on the individuals, helping them talk to each other, it doesn't always work, but I'd say 70, 80% of the time when you may have spent hours trying to persuade reluctant top participants to sit down with you and have a conversation. At the end of it, that seems to be beneficial. And that principle, I think, applies much more broadly than just to commercial mediation. Because ultimately, it's an interpersonal aspect of this process. And in today's climate, today's age, where everything is getting more polarized at all levels, political all the way down to sort of interpersonal, cultural, social level, people are stopping talking to each other.
I have recently been roped into looking at mediation in the context of dealing with inheritance issues amongst family. I did one mediation last year where the father had died, leaving six siblings and grandchildren of you know, adult age, all arguing over the pot. And it was very, it was very disputatious. It was very aggressive. There was a lot of emotion.
And it was brutal.
It was brutal. But I also think forward thinking, before the dispute arises, talking about how you're going to deal with inherited wealth, at those sorts of issues, I think it's useful in that context.
The crossover here between what we do, trying to mediate a dispute in the courts, in the probate courts or whatever, about an inheritance, or about an agreement or will or whatever it is. There's a significant crossover here with sort of a broader family therapy, because what one often finds is a very time-consuming process. And I think there is scope for looking more broadly at who else is brought in to try and help the family move forwards and try and work through those traditional, it's usually third to fourth generation is where the problem comes. First generation, okay. Second generation, sufficiently few people to manage it. Second to third and third to fourth, it all falls apart.
Tony, I know you've done some fairly heavy sort of Jarndyce and Jarndyce kind of cases in the past. Rewarding, challenging?
Very rewarding, those that I have done. Stephen's absolutely right. There are so many aspects of life, including politics, where the skills that are gradually developed need to be deployed. The problem is that there is no institutional or other structure which encourages governments, some of the least sensible attitudes are taken by governments and external affairs departments and foreign secretaries about negotiation, which they claim to know a lot about, but actually then make a complete hash of, that mediators could help with. But there is no institutional background that would enable that to take place, and it's a very great regret.
We have it really easy, I think, because we've got identified parties, so nobody else is involved, it's just those people and those companies, and you can look at that, and that's a defined group. And when you get cases, I did a planning dispute down in the West Country, and it just wasn't clear which members of the community were in the hall involved and which members were outside just being angry and not engaging with the mediation. So there wasn't really a defined client group on either side. And I think politics is like that. I mean, there are just so many interests swirling around and so many different groups that it's enormously difficult to feel as comfortable as we feel when we've got an insurer and a claimant and we know what the issues are and we know it's going to court. And, you know, we have it easy from that point of view.
Can I just make a point about that? Because one of the aspects I've noticed of COVID is that it's changed, or at least has, I think, opportunities significantly to change the way in which we mediate. Before COVID, typically, Bill made the point, we have it very easy. The mediation bundle would thunder onto your desk sometimes as much as 3 days before the mediation day. The mediation began for you then. You got the bundle, you read it, you met the parties 2 days later. It was all easy. What's happening now, at least in my experience in COVID, is you will now be meeting the lawyers maybe 6 weeks on Zoom in advance of the mediation day. So what you now have is the opportunity to plan the process rather than to bring a mediator into a pre-planned process with all the warts and problems that that may have given rise to. And I think that one of the benefits of moving forwards now with the Zoom technology is to bring the mediator and the advisors into engagement at a much earlier stage.
And do they welcome that, Stephen? Or do they, I mean, I can imagine some solicitors would be prickly about that.
They are indeed.
Listen, Bill, just do the job. It's X, it's against Y. Here's the issue. Just, you know, just get back
well,
in your box.
Some cases don't need it. I mean, you've got a straightforward dispute between a reinsured and a reinsurer. It's for £10 million. It's either an avoidance or not. You've got two parties. Those are the two parties. They work it out. But the subtler, the more complicated disputes, particularly multi-party disputes, particularly family disputes, where you need to bring people in. Normally, you can say, that's how I do it. That's how I would strongly recommend we do it. Let's have a meeting. What's it going to cost you? Hour and a half.
Tony, what do you think?
There are boardroom disputes where this comes into reality. I don't know any of you are watching Succession and waiting for the next installment, but there's a case that needs a mediator. And they are excruciatingly difficult because you have the money and you have the personalities, and sometimes there are family companies involved as well, and they're a nightmare. But they demand all the skills that mediators can bring to that issue.
Tony, what do you want to see? What do you think might be going to happen in this business of ours?
I think one of the critical issues for mediators and indeed for civil justice generally is progress on melding together what some people call formal justice compared with informal justice. But there remains real lack of understanding about the difference and how mediation can work. And you have the enthusiasts on one side who want a totally integrated system. You have enthusiasts who say that you should only have an opt-out system of civil justice, so you have to mediate first and only then can you go to the courts. That will be a disaster in my personal view. The fact is that the civil justice system in this country is outrageously expensive. And ordinary people do not have access to justice in a way that they need. And the more that the civil justice system is complicated by ever-expanding rule books and by mechanisms which are forcing people to do things that they don't want to do and depriving them of access to the judges, which is ultimately what they want at an early stage, that is doomed to failure.
One of the most interesting pieces of recent experience was that they introduced in civil money claims online, which is what it says on the tin, they changed it from needing to tick a box to opt into small claims mediation to tick a box to opt out of small claims mediation. Net result, fewer people went to mediation because the theory was that particularly after a defendant had taken the decision, the weighty decision to enter a defence, on the next page, a question comes up, are you prepared to mediate? Well, damn, I'm not prepared to mediate. I've just decided to fight this guy. And the psychology is very interesting, slightly counterintuitive. But Sue, future thoughts? Tell us where you are.
I'm a relative novice, sitting here with you guys who've been doing this for years. I mean, I think I'm enjoying the liberation of not being counsel or advisors on the mediation and being the mediator, because you don't have that overall responsibility for the case, and it gives you a real freedom to be able to assist. You know, my hopes for the future are that I'll get better at doing what I'm doing and I'll keep getting more work, and that there's a greater recognition of the benefits of mediation, because I really think it when it works, it really works. And I think if it starts people, as you say, Stephen, talking to each other, listening and really understanding, it's a good thing. I think there's, so many people don't have proper access to justice. I mean, and if you can cut the costs and cut the wastage and get people to settlements that they can live with, that's only a good thing.
For me, I just have this feeling, I think it's probably unarguable, that mediation is an elite sport to some extent, in two senses. First, it's pretty solidly confined to high-value commercial activity. There's moderate amounts, but tiny fractions, really, lower down the value scale. How we get what we do down into a wider market is hugely difficult. It's highly likely not to be mediation as we know it, Jim. It's likely to be one of various candidates, possibly involving AI, possibly involving telephones. But it won't be the standard CEDA vanilla model, let alone the one with the meeting 6 weeks in advance, because it can't be if a case is worth £3,000 or £4,000. The other sense in which mediation is an elite sport is really is us. I mean, we are very white and very male, sparing Sue's blushes. that again is something, it's a problem that arbitration is wrestling with, that. But mediation is going to be a tougher nut to crack. There are outstanding female mediators, and there's one in the room with us now, but there aren't enough of them. And ethnically, diversity is seriously lacking.
Stephen, the Ones With scheme that you brought me into, I mean, I think it's a fantastic scheme, and I've mediated a couple with them pro bono. It's been, you know, they've been small disputes. I did a Bitcoin dispute between people who had no money. Both sides were acting pro bono.
Rave reviews. I may pass on.
But they settled. We settled. They managed to settle within a couple of hours of a frank discussion on Zoom. Because they didn't have a lot of money on either side, there was a real incentive to try and reach a solution. And it was just about them having somebody to guide that process.
Well, that's the conversation, the opportunity to talk with someone helping them have a conversation. Let me just expand the discussion slightly. Bill makes the point about how sort of white and middle class much mediation is. Yes, in the commercial field, not so in the community field.
Stephen, how do you deal then with getting all these silos to talk to each other and work together?
Well, you need to join it up. It's got to be. I mean, if what we're saying about the importance of this as a process of helping people talk to each other in an age where people have stopped talking to each other, generalisation, but generally true, as most generalisations are, if it's as important as that, what are we going to do about it?
Well, you had to form an anti-silo party, frankly.
Well, because
silos at the moment are antagonistic. It's a serious, serious problem. And the judges have got to be involved in this and understand what it really is and what it really isn't. And the community mediators have to do the same sort of thing. It's a really serious problem, I think.
I mean, I've often thought that commercial mediation that we practice is the tip of the iceberg. It's very visible. It's well-heeled, it involves large amounts of money often, and it's well-funded because you are able to help people avoid hundreds of thousands or millions of pounds of costs. And for that, you get paid a reasonable and very good fee to do that. But the bottom of the iceberg, the 90% below the waterline that's invisible, are the general disputes across society where the mediator skills can be used to try and help it. And I think the joining up of that, the recognition, we need to think about ourselves as being less important, the process more important, that we are looking at trying to integrate aspects of mediation much more broadly.
The logistical challenge is huge. I mean, as we all know, the civil justice system is a very broad-based pyramid, so the vast majority of cases are in the small claims layer. And the real challenge would be a case worth £75,000, high street solicitor on each side, costs already disproportionate. Are we going to spend another 5, 10, whatever it is, to get a room, a mediator? Community mediation wouldn't cover it. It's a litigation case.
Well, it can do because, I mean, the model we use in the community mediation service is to provide a centre where people can come for dispute resolution. It may be community disputes in a tower block, housing estate, whatever it is, and then trying to integrate to provide a service that helps those people resolve it is, I think, doable. I really do.
But, I mean, it doesn't take much, these very small disputes, WOMS.
And
they're fantastic centre. You know, I had 2 pages of mediation statements on the parties. We did it on Zoom. It wasn't hugely costly, I don't think, for either side. It took a day. You have to, you know, be prepared to do it and do these low-cost disputes, but they're incredibly satisfying.
Well, that's why we're so dependent on people, Sue, like you, who join our panel. These are qualified commercial mediators, make themselves available to mediate a small commercial dispute. They waive their fee. The charity charges a modest fee to the parties, which then goes into the non-income generating charitable work.
That is the bridge we need.
That's the link.
That's exactly right.
That's exactly right.
I mean, I think we're all optimistic. I think we're optimistic that we may not have got there yet, but things are going to improve.
I think it's too important not to be optimistic.
When I started mediating, back in the very early days of my mediation career, where in all seriousness, we were told by a speaker that the effect of mediation would be that cases would no longer be referred to as Smith versus Jones, but would be known as Smith and Jones working together on a shared problem. I think we've moved on from that. I think we've discovered that that probably won't happen. It certainly hasn't happened yet. But yet, it's a service that people want. It's a service that we can deliver. And our endeavour has to be to make sure that as many people as possible benefit from mediation or processes like it or processes similar to it. I think it just remains for me to thank the three of you, Stephen, Tony, Sue, for a great discussion. I've really enjoyed it, and many, many thanks.
Thank you, Bill.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you for listening to this programme. You can find out more about this special centenary podcast, the other podcasts in this series, and 100 years of Brickcourt Chambers by visiting our website, brickcourt.co.uk, or by following us on Twitter at @brickcourt.